السلام عليكم ورحمة الله وبركاته. أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم. بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم. الحمد لله رب العالمين. الحمد لله الذي هدانا لهذا وما كنا لنهتدي لولا أن هدانا الله. والصلاة والسلام على سيدنا وعظيمنا وحبيب قلوبنا وطبيب نفوسنا وشفي ذنوبنا أبي القاسم محمد. اللهم صل على محمد وآل محمد. ثم الصلاة والسلام على أهل بيته الطيبين الطاهرين المعصومين المظلومين المنتجبين، لا سيما مولانا وسيدي صاحب الأسر والزمان، روحي وأرواح العالمين له الفداء، وأجل الله تعالى فرجه الشريف، ولعنة دائمة على أعدائهم ومنكر فضائلهم من الآن إلى قيام يوم الدين. صلى الله عليك يا سيدي ويا مولاي يا رسول الله. صلى الله عليك يا سيدي ويا مولاي يا أبا عبد الله، يا رحمة الله الواسعة، ويا باب النجاة الأمة، يا غريب، يا شهيد كربلاء. فقال الله الحكيم في كتابه المبين، بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم، ولقد آتيناك سبعا من المثاني والقرآن العظيم. صدق الله العلي العظيم. For the hastening of the return of our 12th Imam and for our hearts to be purified, one loud salawat upon Muhammad wa Ali Muhammad. Allahumma salli ala Muhammad wa Ali Muhammad. My dear brothers and sisters in Iman, assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. A'azam Allahu ujurana wa ujurakum bi musabina bi Abi Abdillah al-Husayn alayhi salatu wa salam. Let me begin by again extending my condolences to all of the brothers and sisters who are tuning into these majalis as we commemorate this year of Muharram 2020, 1442 of the Islamic calendar. And as we know that these Muharram commemorations this year are of a unique method, unfortunately we're not able to gather in the center to remember Abu Abdullah. But this virtual form that we have been blessed with is the best that we can do given the circumstances. And obviously we make the best of what we have been given. And we thank Allah that He has at least given us this opportunity to once again commemorate the tragedy of Karbala. And not just to commemorate and to remember the tragedy, but hopefully to learn lessons of the story of Karbala. What led to it, what happened during it, and what the outcome was, and where we fit into this grand equation. Tonight, in the second night of Muharram, we continue in the discussion that we began last night. And as you'll recall, our overall theme has been dealing with temporal strife through living a Quranic life. And the goal behind these 10 nights is for us to be able to recognize the fact that we are living in very difficult times. We have always lived in difficult times, no doubt. But when you look at the time that we are living in today, in these last 6 months, and only Allah knows how much longer this pandemic will reside, we look at the fact and we realize that when it comes to previous years, tragedies or adversities or difficulties have been limited. For example, when a war happens, as when Afghanistan was attacked, as when Iraq was attacked, as when Daesh took over large portions of Iraq and Syria and that region, this was limited to a particular geographic region. When a flood occurs, that flood is limited to that particular country or state or province. When famines happen in certain parts of the world. But COVID-19 has shown us clearly that we can be affected at a global level. And so when a global adversity comes upon us, when a challenge comes from wherever it has come from, we realize that we need a global solution to a global problem. And our topic for these nights is that global solution. That is the Quran. And obviously not only the Quran, the book of Allah, but the teachers of the Quran, the Prophet, and the family members, the Ahlul Bayt, alayhum as-salatu was-salam. And so tonight I want to look in the second topic for this evening, at Surah Al-Fatiha, the key to the solution of all of our problems. Now, the verse that I began with comes to us from chapter number 15, Surah Al-Hijr, verse number 87. It's a very interesting verse, it's very short. In it, Allah says, وَلَكَدْ أَتَيْنَاكَ سَبْعًا مِنَ الْمَثَانِي وَالْقُرْآنِ الْعَظِيمِ. Indeed, we have given to you, O Muhammad, the seven often repeated verses, سَبْعًا مِنَ الْمَثَانِي وَالْقُرْآنِ الْعَظِيمِ, and the great Qur'an, this Qur'an which Allah describes as azim, as something which is tremendous, which is something which is great. Now, this particular verse of the Qur'an is interesting on many fronts. And I want to lead into my topic tonight by this verse of the Qur'an. As we said that I want to look at Surah Al-Fatiha tonight and how it is and it presents the solution to all of our problems today as believers, as human beings. Now, this verse, as I said, from chapter 15, verse 87, where Allah tells the Prophet that indeed we have given you the sab'an min al-mathani, the seven often repeated verses. Our scholars, the scholars of commentary of Quran who follow the tradition of the Ahlul Bayt, alayhim as-salam, they have said that one of the interpretations, if not the prime meaning of this verse in their estimation, in their understanding, is Surah Al-Fatiha, the Sab'an min al-Mathani. That's the main opinion. There are other opinions that it refers to seven of the largest chapters of the Quran. But the opinion that we look at tonight is that this refers to Surah Al-Fatiha. And if you look at it in this verse, it's interesting because Allah is saying, we have given you, O Rasul, sab'an min al-mathani, these seven often repeated verses, wal-Quran al-azim. What Allah is saying here is Allah is putting whatever these seven often repeated verses are at the same level as the entire Quran. Sab'an min al-mathani, wal-Quran al-azim, on the other hand. Two of these become equal in weight. And we'll see in our discussion tonight how this is a reality and how this chapter needs to be infused within our lives. Now, just a few points about this before I go to the main area of discussion for this evening. If this is the interpretation which our scholars have given is accurate, that the Sab'an min al-Mathani are the seven verses of Surah Al-Fatiha, we know that this is the most often recited chapter of the Quran. A minimum of 10 times every day, you and I recite Surah Al-Fatiha. In fact, we have the very famous hadith of our Prophet Muhammad, sallallahu alayhi wa alihi wa sallam, where he says, La salat illa bi fatihat al-kitab. That there is no salat except with the Fatiha, with the opening chapter of the Quran. And you know, just as a side note, in terms of the ahkam, the fiqh, the jurisprudence, if you are in a situation, let's say you don't have much time, the time for, let's say you came home late from school or work and your time for Asr or Dhuhr is very limited, the scholars tell us, the Marajas say that if you need, you can drop the second surah. But Surah Fatiha has to be recited. So you might say, well, I don't have time to recite the two surahs because of this emergency. And in certain circumstances, that is allowed to be dropped. But Fatiha til Kitab is always there. It is a part, integral part of the daily prayers of a believer. Another reason why our scholars tell us that this chapter is so important is it was revealed twice to Rasulullah. You know, I would say that all of the rest of the Quran, from my understanding, was revealed one time to the Prophet. Meaning, if when Surah Al-Kawthar came to the Prophet, it came down one time. When Surah Al-Kafirun was revealed to Rasulullah, it was revealed one time. But Surah Al-Fatiha is so important that Allah revealed it twice to Rasulullah. Once in Mecca, and incidentally this was the first complete chapter of the Quran to be revealed, and once in Medina. Now you and I know, and when we go and we teach our children about the basics of Islam, that the very first verse to come down to Rasulullah was the first verses of Surah Al-Alaq, Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim, Iqra, Bismi Rabbikal Ladhi Khalaq, Khalaqal Insana Min Alaq. That was the first revelation, the first wahi to Rasulullah. But that's not the first chapter that was revealed. It was not revealed in complete form. Surah Al-Fatiha was revealed in complete form, full totality, 7 verses, to Rasulullah. Now, I just want to mention one more point, which, you know, has become an issue of discussion amongst the Muslim Ummah, the Shia and the Ahlul Sunnah. And I don't say this to mock or make fun of the Ahlul Sunnah and their fiqh, but it's important for you and I as Shia to realize our heritage, our tradition, our hadith, our ahkam, our ulama, right? And sometimes we know more about the Sunni hadith, the Sunni scholarship, the Sunni fatawa, the Sunni opinions, more than our own, because we sometimes have to deal with them at work. Many of the young brothers and sisters, if you're at university, you know, you have MSAs on campus and you might be participating in some of the programs, and sometimes you get caught up in polemical discussions, the Shia-Sunni issues. So let me just mention this as we move on, that this first verse of Surah Al-Fatiha, Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim, in the name of Allah, the All-Merciful, the All-Compassionate, this is a verse like no other. And unfortunately, amongst the Muslim community, there is such a diversity of opinion that sometimes it leaves you scratching your head that where do the scholars get these opinions from? Now, let me first at the outset say this, as Shia Ithna Ashari, Imami Shias, we follow the 12 Imams from Imam Ali to Imam Al-Mahdi. May Allah bless all of them and may Allah hasten the return of our 12th Imam. All of our ulama are unanimous that the basmala, the phrase Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim, is a independent part of every surah of the Quran. So yes, it's written at the top of every verse or every surah, except for chapter number 9, Surah Tawbah. But it is a part of that chapter. We might not count it as verse number 1, but it is a part of the surah. And as we know, it is an obligation, it is wajib to recite that phrase, Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim, when we recite the Quran, specifically in the Salat. Now, should you recite the Bismillah if you're just at home reading Quran? It's better to recite it for the barakah of it, because of the fact that the chapter was revealed with it. We should recite the Bismillah as well. But without a doubt, in the Salat, in the daily prayers, for men and women, it is an obligation to recite the Bismillah. Now, do we recite it out loud, like I'm speaking right now, as we pray Fajr, Maghrib, and Isha? Or do we recite it quietly, like we do when we recite Salat al-Dhuhr and Asr? Obviously, we know that for Fajr, Maghrib, and Isha, it's recited, we are highly advised to recite it out loud in an audible voice. For men, for women, if there are non-mahram men present, then it is not allowed for them to recite this out loud or any of the adhkar out loud. But for men, we have to recite it, we should recite it out loud. And obviously the chapters of the Quran, as for men, for the three prayers, Fajr, Maghrib, and Isha, must be recited out loud. Now, the reason I bring this up and I say and I emphasize on this point that we have to recite these out loud. And we know we have the hadith also, just incidentally, from the 11th Imam, Imam Al-Askari, alayhi salatu wassalam, in which he tells us that the alamat of the Shia, or the alamat of the believer, are 5. One of them is a ziyarat of arba'in, wearing a ring on the right hand, putting the forehead on the dust of on dirt when we go into sajda, belief in the mi'raj of the Prophet being a physical mi'raj, and the one thing he says is to recite the Bismillah jahran in an open voice. When within the Sunni community, again, I bring this up not to mock them or to for any other reason, but just for us to know and understand these differences, is within the Ahlul Sunnah community, their jurists have a difference of opinion. And we know that they have 4 major schools of fiqh. And their opinions are diverse, from it being permissible to recite the Bismillah. Some say it's permissible, but it must be recited in a quiet whisper, as we do for Salat al-Dhuhr and Asr, so nobody else can hear you. Others say that when it comes to Fajr, Maghrib, and Isha, it is permissible, it is okay, it is mubah to recite it out loud. And then you have an extreme opinion on the other side of the spectrum, which says what? It says that it is not allowed to read the Bismillah in the wajib prayers. Forget about out loud or quietly, it's not allowed. You're not allowed to do it. And finally, let me just share with you one quotation as I move on. This is from the Encyclopedia of Fiqh, and it gives the well-known opinion of the Maliki school of thought. And it says that the well-known opinion of the Maliki school of thought is that the Basmala, this phrase Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim, is not a verse of the Quran, except in Surah An-Naml, where it is a part of a verse, and it is disliked for the Imam or anybody else who is making their Salat to recite the Bismillah out loud in the obligatory prayers, both with the Fatiha or before any other chapter of the Quran. Now that's an extreme opinion, I would say. Extreme when we look at it from the point of view of the Prophet and the Ahlul Bayt alayhim as-salam. Let me give you one more hadith and I'll move on. This hadith comes to us from our Imams of the Ahlul Bayt alayhim as-salam, and specifically Abu Abdullah, Imam Ja'far as-Sadiq, may God's peace and blessings be upon him. So the 5th and 6th and maybe even the 7th Imam, they had a companion named Safwan. Safwan ibn Mihran al-Asadi, but he's known as Safwan al-Jamal. Al-Jamal, as you know, we know when we look, read the history of this individual, he was a person who had a small business. He had camels, and he used to rent camels out for people who needed to go on a journey. You know, like much like today, you go to Budget or Enterprise to rent a car, and they have a large fleet of cars available. Safwan had a large fleet of camels available, and his job was to rent camels to people who needed them. So one day, what happens? The 6th Imam, Imam Sadiq, peace be upon him, comes to Safwan, and he says, you know, Safwan, I like you. You're a good Shia. And for an Imam of the Ahlul Bayt to say that he likes you, obviously that's something tremendous. But the 6th Imam says one point. He says, Safwan, I like you, but I have one problem with you. Now, this man must be thinking, what kind of a problem can my Imam have with me? The 6th Imam says, you know, Safwan, I've got a problem in that you have this business where you rent camels to people, and the problem I have is that you are renting them to Harun, the Abbasid Caliph. As we know that after Banu Umayyah, there was a transition period to the Banu Abbas. So Harun is in power and Safwan is renting his camels to him. The 6th Imam says, I don't like this. This is something which doesn't flow with me. I don't like it. The companion Safwan al-Jamal says to the Imam, Yabna Rasulullah, he says, O son of the Messenger of God, he says, I'm not renting him my camels that he can go and commit sin and murder people. I give it the camels to him to rent because he goes for Hajj and he needs to have obviously camels for himself, his entourage, his goods, everything he's carrying. That's why I'm giving him the camels to rent. The 6th Imam says to Safwan, he says, does the caliph pay you in advance or do you collect your payment when he returns? He says, of course, he pays me when he comes back. I don't take, you know, maybe he takes a deposit, but I get paid when he returns. So the 6th Imam says to Safwan, he says, yeah, Safwan. He says, when your camels go and the caliph takes them away and he's going for Hajj, do you make dua? Do you pray that he comes back safely? He says, of course I make dua, because if he doesn't come back, I'm not getting paid and I probably lose my camels as well. And this is where the Imam said, this is the problem that I have. Because you are making prayer, you are making dua for an oppressive leader, a tyrant, an unjust individual. You're praying for him to stay alive till he comes back from the Hajj because you want your money. And at this point, Safwan basically took a step back and reanalyzed his life and thought about his priorities. Does he want to be beloved by the Imam of Ahlul Bayt and by Allah? Or does he want the dollars? Does he want the gold and silver that the caliph will provide him? Historians say that Safwan sold the entire flock of camels. He got out of the camel renting business. And when the caliph heard about this, he asked Safwan, he says, "What happened? I knew that you had this camel business I've rented from you. Why did you all of a sudden sell everything?" And Safwan tells him, "You know, I'm getting old. I'm having difficulties. My servants can't do the job. So I thought I'd just get out of the business altogether." The caliph was a bit of a shrewd man, a smart man, and he says that, "No, you're lying. I know where you got this answer from. It's from your imam." And he says that had I not had respect for you and this history of being, you know, with you, I would have killed you immediately. So this is Safwan, a very noble man, a very trustworthy man. And so we have a hadith from Safwan where he says that, "Sallaytu khalfa Abi Abdullah alayhi salam ayyaman. I prayed my salat behind the sixth imam ayyaman for many days, for a long time." And he says that every time we prayed the salat, whatever it be, fajr or dhuhr or asr or maghrib or isha, every time he would start the salat, he would say loudly, "Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim." And Safwan goes on to say that he would also recite the Bismillah. He says, "Wakana yajharu fil suratain jami'an." That even when he finished the first surah, Al-Fatiha, went to the second surah, he recited the Bismillah. The reason I take you through this event, brothers and sisters, is for us to realize that the Imams of Ahlul Bayt, 12 Imams, look at how long they were in, the Imamate lasted, from Amir al-Mu'mineen in 11 Hijri, all the way till the Ghaiba of the 12th Imam, which began in around 320, the major occultation begins. For over 300 years, our 12 Imams governed, they ruled, maybe not by the rule of the people, but they ruled the hearts. They gave fatawa, they gave verdicts on Islam, and they had no difference of opinion. The first Imam and the 12th Imam, the fiqh is the same. The fiqh of Imam Sadiq alayhi salam, the same that his, you know, his great-grandson would have taught. The same thing his son Imam Al-Kadhim taught. The same his grandson Imam Ar-Ridha alayhi salam taught. There's no difference between them. And this is the beauty of Ahlul Bayt, brothers and sisters. They don't take us on different paths. They don't say, you know, we don't say, well, we have 12 Imams, so we have 12 different Islams. No, we have one Islam. Yes, there are certain minor differences in the Ahkam, but there are no major differences in them. This Bismillah, and let me just move on with this, is so important. Give you a story that happened at the time of Muawiyah. You know, we've talked about Muawiyah last night a bit, and we have obviously issues with this individual, and the Prophet also has very clear ahadith about the status of Muawiyah. But one time Muawiyah had made his way to Medina, and he was offering the Jama'at prayers, leading the prayers in Medina, and he did not recite the Bismillah. He started straight with Alhamdulillahi Rabbil Alameen, Ar-Rahman Ar-Rahim Maliki Yawmideen, and he finished the Fatiha, did the second surah, finished the Salat. The people of Medina, the companions who were in Medina at that time, there was an uproar in the masjid. They were furious. What did this man do? And the statement that historians quote is they say, "Asarakta? Amnasita? Have you stolen something from us? You've stolen this Bismillah? Or have you forgotten? Did you forget to recite the Bismillah when you started Fatiha and the second surah?" The historians say that Muawiyah actually re-read the Salat. He redid that prayer with the Bismillah in place. And scholars offer an explanation here. And they say that perhaps he did this. Well, not perhaps, but he most definitely did this intentionally. Because whatever Amir al-Mu'mineen, Imam Ali alayhi salam, used to do, he would do the opposite. And so Imam Ali was known to recite the Bismillah out loud because this is the obligation that the Prophet did. But Muawiyah wanted to ensure that he did not follow in that tradition. And so he did opposite to the commander of the faithful. Coming to the topic for tonight, as we said, is Surah Al-Fatiha. the key to the solution of all of our problems. Now, that is a very bold claim for me to make. And inshallah, in the time that I have remaining, we will try and unpack these seven verses to see how we can live Surah Al-Fatiha within our lives. Again, my dear brothers and sisters, this chapter of the Quran is, I think, very underestimated in our lives. It's only seven verses, and we think, well, we recite it so much every day, 10 times a day, 70 times a week, you know, 210 times a month or so, thousands of times a year, that we take it for granted, the content of it. We might not even think about what we're saying. We became so habituated, so accustomed, so natured to it, that we don't even think about Surah Al-Fatiha anymore. But actually, the entire content of the Quran is encapsulated, is contained within Surah Al-Fatiha. Now, how do I say that? If you look at how our scholars have broken up the Quran, they break it up into at least five portions. They say about 31% of the Quran is about ma'rifatullah, knowing Allah, recognizing Allah, who our Creator is. This is seen in Surah Al-Fatiha, Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. We talk about Allah, ar-Rahman, ar-Rahim. They say that also we look at Alhamdulillahi Rabbil Alameen. We refer to God as the Rabbul Alameen. Again, we get to know God through that. 26% of the Quran is about Yawm Al-Qiyamah, the Day of Judgment. About heaven and hell, accountability, actions, repercussions. 26% of the Quran is about Yawm Al-Qiyamah. What does Surah Fatiha say? Maliki Yawm Al-Din, the master, the owner of the Day of Judgment. 24% of the Quran is about prophethood and leadership, Nubuwa, Risala, Imama. Leadership is an integral part of Islam. And what does the Quran say in Surah Al-Fatiha? Sirata alladhina an'amta alayhim, the path of those whom you have blessed. This is the path, brothers and sisters, of the prophets, of the shuhada, of the salihin, of the siddiqeen, of the awliya of Allah. 12% of the Quran to go on is about Ahlul Kitab, the Jews and Christians, and the polytheists and other groups. In Surah Fatiha, what do we say? غَيْرِ الْمَغْذُوبِ عَلَيْهِمْ وَلَا الضَّالِينَ. People who have earned the anger of Allah, there are a certain group of people in history, and the dhalin, those who have been deviated, misguided. Again, other people from within the previous traditions and dispensations that had come through various prophets and their teachings. And the fifth part of the Quran, and we'll move on with this, is the rules, the ahkam, and the akhlaq that is within the Quran, the teachings about righteousness, about goodness to parents, goodness to the neighbors, to our family members, to the relatives. And in the Surah Fatiha, we say, not only Ar-Rahman Ar-Rahim, we say, Iyaka na'budu wa Iyaka nasta'in. So you can see at this very simplistic, rudimentary level, that the entire Quran, these five main themes of the Quran, are contained within the Fatiha. So now let me go and look at verse by verse to see how we can solve our problems today with Surah Al-Fatiha. But before that, one loud salawat upon Muhammad wa Ali Muhammad, please. We begin with the very first verse of Surah Fatiha. Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim. And as I said, that this is a verse of the Quran. This is the verse of that chapter. And when I say that I begin in the name of Allah, who is the All-Merciful, the All-Compassionate, how does this reflect in my life? One thing, and I'm just going to try to mention one point per verse, is that we need to realize actively in the forefront of our mind that every action that we do needs to be started in the name of Allah, for the sake of Allah, and following the rules of Allah. If we were to live this in model within our lives, I guarantee you we could never commit a sin. Because a sin is where we break the rules of Allah, where we transgress the limits of Allah, where we do things for other than Allah, for our friends at school who push us to do haram, for our family, to fit in with the community, we commit haram. But if we begin every action with the name of Allah, for Allah, following the rules of Allah, if we regulate every aspect of our lives, we would be on a path to be, if not infallible, very close to that. Very close to being people who don't make sin, at least intentionally. Unintentionally, maybe, but not intentionally. Because Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim would regulate our lives, that we would realize that everything that we are doing is for the sake of Allah. And it is in following what He expects from us. Now we move on to the next verse. Alhamdu lillahi rabbil alameen. All praise belongs to Allah, the Lord of Alameen, of the universe. Or not even the universe, we have to actually expand that and say that He is the Lord of everything in existence. La ilaha illahu. There is no God other than Him. There is no Rabb other than Him. There is no Khalik other than Him. He is all that there is. And when we say this verse, we have to recognize and thank Allah for everything that we have. Again, we're looking at how does Surah Fatiha regulate our lives? How could we make a change in our lives through Surah Al-Fatiha? Alhamdulillahi Rabbil Alameen, everything that we have is because of Allah. And the things that we do not have are because of Allah as well, to an extent. Or we could say in general. Many times, you know, we wake up in the morning and we can hear, we can see, we can speak, we can walk, our hands function. We thank Allah. Or do we actually thank Allah is a question I have to ask myself. And you ask yourselves that every morning you wake up, do you say, Ya Allah, thank you that my eyes are functioning today. I could have woken up blind. Ya Allah, thank you for giving me health. I could have woken up with COVID-19. Ya Allah, thank you for not having me be challenged with cancer or many other challenges that other people out there in the world are facing today. This is a thing that we don't only read every day, Alhamdulillahi Rabbil Alameen, but this is something we need to begin to inculcate in our personal day-to-day lives. If you have a mother and father, and you wake up and your mom and dad are there and they made you breakfast, or your parents make you lunch, or you go out to a restaurant for them for dinner with them, have you thanked Allah for that? There are many millions of young boys and girls out there today in Iraq, in Syria, in Lebanon, in Afghanistan, in Pakistan, in India, in Africa, in North America, who don't have parents. They wake up to strangers who take care of them, or they're living in the foster shelter system. They don't have a mother and father to provide for them. Do we thank Allah for this blessing that He has given to us? The next verse that we have to remember and inculcate in our lives, Ar-Rahman Ar-Rahim. Now, we might think, well, this is repetition. Didn't I just say Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim? Why did Allah repeat Ar-Rahman ar-Rahim? Why didn't He say Al-Malik al-Quddus, As-Salam al-Mu'min, Al-Ghafir al-Tawwab? He could have used any other combination of names. Why did He say Ar-Rahman ar-Rahim? Why did Allah, quote-unquote, repeat Himself? Maybe it's for you and I to realize that this mercy of Allah, this Rahmaniyah and Rahimiyah, they come from the same source of Rahma, but they're two different levels of Rahma that God gives. He is the all-merciful, all-compassionate, not only to Muslims, but to non-Muslims. Ya man yu'ti man sa'ala, ya man yu'ti man yas'alhu, wa man lam ya'arifhu. We say in the dua in Rajab, O Allah, the one who gives to those who ask and don't ask, who know Him and who don't even know Him. Allah gives to everybody because He is Ar-Rahman. Ar-Rahman is a general name, but it applies to everything in creation. Whereas Ar-Rahim is a specific, is, is, is a name that is universal, but it's only applicable to the believers. So Ar-Rahman is a name of Allah which is only it has this universal appeal, but Ar-Rahim is very narrow and is only for those who accept Allah as their Lord, as their God, as their cherisher. And more than that, I would say that when we say this 10 times a day, just in this verse, forget about the fact that another 20 times we're saying it in the Bismillah, is the fact that we have to be merciful. When we're at work or at school or in the malls or wherever we may be, we have to show mercy to people. Again, whether they be Muslim or not, it makes no difference. This is a universal requirement of the Muslims. Going to the next verse, verse number 4, and time is running out, so I want to try and conclude this in the next few moments. Maliki Yawmiddin, or Maliki Yawmiddin, the master or the owner or the king of the day of judgment, the authority of the day of retribution, the day when all of us will stand in front of Allah, and all we will have to show are the deeds and the intentions behind those actions that we performed. This one verse would really be enough to control the lives of a human being, control the life of a human being rather, if we were to understand it. If we realize that we are being watched by Allah, just like I am being watched by this camera right now, just like when we go into the malls or the shopping centers or the stores and they have security cameras to track our every moment from the time we walk into the front of the front door of the store, we go in the aisles until we pay and we leave, we're being watched. Allah has a much better system of surveillance in place. He is obviously the greatest of all those who watches, but then he has the two angels, Kiram al-Katibin, and they write our actions. And we have the Prophet and the Imams of Ahlul Bayt alayhim as-salam also as witnesses over our actions. So if we realize this and we again delve deeper into this, we would realize and we would understand that this one verse as well could change our perception on life. How we deal with other people, how we deal with ourselves, how we deal with our Creator Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. We then move on to verse number 5, إِيَّاكَ نَعْبُدُ وَإِيَّاكَ نَسْتَعِينَ. We only worship Allah, we only turn to Allah for help. And this is obviously one of the most important issues in Islam, is monotheism, tawheed, and the various forms or the aspects of tawheed that our ulama speak about. And we have to realize, brothers and sisters, that we only rely on Allah, we don't turn to other people. Yes, when I go to work, I get a paycheck from my company. But that paycheck comes through Allah. He's the means. Everything we do is through Allah's ability He has given us and what He has distributed around the world. Allah doesn't come directly, for example, and feed the hungry. No, Allah gives you and I money through our jobs, through our income and our savings, and we give that to the needy. But ultimately, Allah has provided it to us, and it trickles down from us to the needy, and it goes back again from Allah, and it comes back down the chain again. But we realize that we only worship Allah. We don't worship people. We don't worship the Prophet. We don't worship the Imams of Ahlul Bayt. And, you know, many times the youth ask me, we go to Karbala, we go to Najaf, we go to the shrine cities, and it looks like people are worshipping the Dhari. It looks like they're worshipping the enclosed structure where Aba Abdullah is buried, or people are kissing a flag, or kissing the floor, or kissing the door of the Haram. Is this not shirk? And we have to realize, and this is a lengthy discussion, I don't have time for it tonight, but that's not shirk, unless you attribute that door to having power, which it doesn't. Unless you attribute the dhari of the imam to having independence outside of the authority of Allah, which it doesn't. If you believe that the Prophet or the imam of the Ahlul Bayt have power independent of Allah, then you're into the field of shirk. But if you and I understand that The intercession can come from them with the power of Allah. They can cure, or they can grant us a cure, shafa'ah, if Allah permits, just as Prophet Isa did. When we realize that is the understanding, then these actions of going for a ziyarah do not become shirk, because I could throw that same question back to that non-Shia and say, when you pray towards the Kaaba, or better yet, when you go to Mecca and you stand in front of the Kaaba and you kiss the black stone or you touch that black stone, a non-Muslim will look at you and say, you're worshipping a black rock. But you'll say, no, I don't worship a rock. I worship in a direction, but I worship God. So it's on perception and intention. But unfortunately, many of our non-Shia brethren, they've looked at us as being worshippers of the imams and the shrines and the graves, not realizing that we don't do that. We never associate any partners with Allah. Coming to verse number 6, اِهْدِنَا الصِّرَاطَ الْمُسْتَقِيمِ. Guidance, guide us to the straight path, keep us on the straight path. This is a very important line of the surah, brothers and sisters, because deviation is always a possibility. You can be the greatest of worshippers of Allah. Look at Iblis, Shaitan, Satan in the Quran, and rather in Najul Balagha, Amir al-Mu'mineen, Imam Ali alayhi salam says that Iblis worshipped Allah for 6,000 years. And then he goes on to say, whether these earthly years or heavenly years, he doesn't tell us. He says 6,000 years, this creation of God worshipped Allah, and in an instant he lost everything. He is now mal'oon. He is now the rajim, the cursed Satan, the one that we ask Allah to remove from his mercy. So deviation, brothers and sisters, is always possible. And that's why we take our guidance, as I said at the beginning, only from the Quran and only from the Ahlul Bayt. Now in the period of the Ghaybah, the occultation of our Imam, where do you and I go? We have no other choice. If you are not a mujtahid or a mujtahida, if you don't have the ability to practice ihtiyat, to be a muhtat, to be a precaution, then you and I have to do taqleed. And I know taqleed is a major issue. Many of our youth are questioning this validity of marja'iyat and taqleed and following a scholar who lives in Najaf or Qum or in Karbala or in wherever, and they are out of tune and out of touch with society. And maybe one night we can discuss it, or if one of the questions comes up, we can discuss it more in detail. But suffice it to mention that if you and I don't know what our responsibility is to Allah, we know we have to pray. How? You know you have to fast. How? You know, and I know, we have all these obligations, but the Quran does not spell them out verbatim. So how do you follow what you need to do? The logical solution is either A, you and I go and become scholars, jurists, faqis, mujtahids, men and women, and we derive the rules for ourselves, or we say, I can't do it. I'm going to follow a scholar who has the ability to get me to my responsibility. In a nutshell, that is taqleed. The seventh and the last verse is where we say, سِرَاطَ الَّذِينَ أَنْعَمْتَ عَلَيْهِمْ غَيْرِ الْمَغْذُوبِ عَلَيْهِمْ وَلَا الضَّالِينَ. We're elaborating on the previous statement where we ask God to guide us or keep us on the straight path. But what is that path? Because today, you go onto the internet and you just type in Islam, just as a keyword in the search engine, and you would find probably a billion different hits for Islam. You'll find Salafis, you'll find Wahhabis, you'll find followers of Ibn Taymiyyah, you'll find people who follow the Aga Khan, the Ismailis, you'll find the 5% Nation of Islam, You'll find the many divergent groups who have completely destroyed Islam. And then you'll find the Ithna Ashiris as well, the Shias. So what is the right path? There's millions of ways to submit to Allah. There are so, you know, 1.8 billion Muslims. So what is the right Islam to follow? It's Sirat al-Ladina an'amta alayhim, the path of those whom Allah has given His blessings to. Now that in itself is an entire topic. How do we determine who those are? And my time will not permit me to look at that tonight. But we do tell Allah that we are looking for the path that He has put blessings upon. Not the path of those who have earned His anger, His ghadab. And again, we'll have to look at that in the Quran. Who had angered Allah? Not that Allah has emotions like you and I. He gets happy and sad. No, there's a definition of ghadab, of the anger of Allah and what that means. And it's not people who are dhaleen, who are the misguided. Allah sent 124,000 prophets. Five of them were Ulul Azm, Nuh, Ibrahim, Musa, Isa, and Prophet Muhammad sallallahu alayhi wa alihi wa sallam wa alayhim wa salam. Some of those followers of these prophets are maghdubi alayhim. They have Allah's anger. Some of them are dhaleen, some of them are deviants. Today, we have to determine who those are. And more importantly, we have to determine who are the people who are on the path of Allah. That's really what counts, brothers and sisters, is who are on the right path. How do we determine that from the Quran, from the authenticated hadith, if we have to go that route? And we stick to those individuals. We don't let that waver. We don't waver from that path. In a nutshell, and let me end in this next minute, that reading this chapter of the Quran, Surah Al-Fatiha, going through this surah verse by verse and reflecting on it and thinking upon it and dissecting it as we have tried to do in these last 20 or 30 minutes, this will get us to be able to realize that Surah Al-Fatiha contains the entire Quran, and more than that, it contains everything that you and I need in life. The Quran, the rest of the 113 chapters, don't get me wrong, they're important. They explain these seven verses. They further elaborate on these seven verses. But if we can grasp Al-Fatiha, if we can take it to heart, if we can learn the lessons of Al-Fatiha, then we're on the road to solving many of our problems that we have in our lives today. Salu ala Muhammadin wa ali Muhammad. Before I conclude, let me just take a few minutes to end. In these nights of Muharram, obviously, we need to reflect on the tragedy of Karbala, because that's what we're here for after all. The importance of Muharram, and although there were a few questions that were asked, we will answer them inshallah in a few moments. But one of them is about this importance of Muharram and how do we commemorate it. Brothers and sisters, let me just give you two traditions and we'll conclude for this evening. With the importance of the commemoration of Karbala and the tragedy of Ashura, the eighth Imam, Imam Ar-Ridha alayhi salatu wassalam, the Gharib Imam, the one who's buried far away from his ancestors in the city of Mashhad, he has a hadith where he says he would look at his father, Imam Al-Kadhim, the seventh Imam, Imam Musa ibn Ja'far. And the eighth Imam would say that when the month of Muharram would start, when the new moon would be seen for the month of Muharram, he says, my father, Imam Al-Kadhim, would never be seen. Forget about laughing and joking and having fun. He said he would never even be seen smiling in the month of Muharram, or at least in the beginning 10 days of Muharram. He says, La yura dhahikan. He was never seen laughing, smiling. And he says that this state of gloom, of sadness, this state of remorse that my father was in, that this continued from the first of Muharram to the second, to the third, all the way to Yawm al-Ashir, to the 10th of Muharram. And then Imam Ar-Ridha alayhi salam says that when the 10th of Muharram would dawn, he said that that was a day that my father took as a day of huzn, a day of grief, and a day of buqa, a day of crying, and a day of lamentation. Brothers and sisters, the Imams of Ahlul Bayt gave us a prescription with how to commemorate Karbala. Yes, this is the same event you heard last year. What you'll hear this year has not changed from what you heard last year, or that you heard the year before, or that you heard 10 years ago. The story is the same. But our hearts go through fluctuations. And we have to seize the opportunity and commemorate and remember this event, not only as a remembrance, but to change our lives. Let me end with one tradition, which is that from the sixth Imam, Imam Jafar al-Sadiq, a man, a companion named Abu Ammar, would come to the Imam one time, and this is narrated by Ibn Kulaway in his Kamal al-Ziyarat. He narrates a hadith where this companion Abu Ammar comes to Abu Abdullah, Imam Jafar al-Sadiq alayhi salam. The Imam asks him to recite some poetry about the tragedy of Karbala. And he recites one poem about the tragedy of Karbala. And the Imam is in a state of grief. He asked the man to recite a second poem, or recite a third poem, recite a fourth poem. He asked him to recite it in a certain style of poetic recitation. The Imam cries, and he begins to tell this man what rewards this man will get, or what rewards a person would get. And he tells him, he says that if through this poetry 100 people are brought to tears, then Jannah, paradise, is an obligation. Then he drops it down to 90 people if they're moved to tears, then 80, then 70, then 60, then 50, then 40, then 30, then 20, then 10. If 10 people cry, the Imam says, then Jannah, paradise, is an obligation upon you. And then the Imam says, O Abu Ammar, even if you yourself recite the poetry of Abu Abdullah and you cry, then, or rather, if one person cries, Jannah is wajib upon you. And then he says, even if you cry, you are on your own in your room, as many of us are now trapped at home because of COVID. We can't go to the majlis. Maybe we recite a poetry like the young sister recited yesterday after the majlis about Karbala. The Imam says, even if you cry over your own words of poetry, paradise is an obligation that you have to be given. And the Imam then takes one last step, and I'll end with this, and he says that even if you try to cry, you can't cry. The tears don't come out of the eyes. You can't shed a tear for Abu Abdullah. You don't have it within you for whatever reason. He says, don't worry about it. Jannah is still waiting for you. Paradise is written for you. You will deserve, and you will, God willing, get paradise. Brothers and sisters, as we conclude on this second night of Muharram, we ask Allah to allow us to be moved by the teachings of Abu Abdullah alayhi salam. We ask Allah to allow us to be able to change our lives for the better. We ask Allah for us to be kept away from all of the difficulties that this world is facing. And we ask Allah to hasten in the return of our 12th Imam, Imam al-Hujjah, ajjalallahu ta'ala farajahu al-sharif. Rabbana taqabbal minna innaka anta as-samiul alim wa sayalamu alladhina zalamu ayyamun qalibin yanqalibun inna lillahi wa inna ilayhi raji'un. Salu ala Muhammad wa ali Muhammad.